Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
And if there's one thing that has unified Democrats and Republicans and everybody in between, it's that we all hated the bank bailout. I hated it. I hated it. I hated it. You hated it. It was about as popular as a root canal.
So if there's a State of the Union angle that I think is being underreported this morning, it's probably how much time President Obama spent last night defending what he has already done for the economy.
Because of the steps we took, there are about 2 million Americans working right now who would otherwise be unemployed. $200,000 work in construction and clean energy. $300,000 are teachers and other education workers. Tens of thousands are cops, firefighters, correctional officers, first responders. And we're on track to add another 1.5 million jobs to this total by the end of the year. The plan that has made all of this possible, from the tax cuts to the jobs, is the Recovery Act. That's right. The Recovery Act, also known as the stimulus bill.
All right, America, love the stimulus bill and the bank bailout. Please, people, show them some love. And listeners, that's one question for you today. After watching or listening to the speech or carefully rereading the full text online, as I'm sure you've done four times, do you feel better about what the president has done on the economy so far? For now, post your answer to WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer Show. Later, we'll take your phone calls. And you can react any other way you want, of course. But that's one question for us today. After watching or listening to the speech, do you feel better about what the president has done on the economy so far? WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer Show. We'll take phone calls later. Melissa Harris-Lacewell is here, professor of politics and African-American studies at Princeton. Professor Harris-Lacewell, welcome back to WNYC.
It's great to be here.
And what struck you most about the State of the Union address?
Well, you know, it's interesting. I think it depends a great deal on who you are, sort of what you heard. You know, for me, actually, the key moment was the possibility of the forgiveness of student loans, because although I'm already a decade into teaching, it is still my primary debt is my student loan debt. So there are these moments when you know, I just sort of heard the president say sort of policy agenda items that felt good to hear.
And was it clear to you, by the way, how that would work? We were trying to get details of that yesterday to no avail.
Not only is it not clear to me how it would work, I'm deeply suspicious that it's likely to happen, because
really?
I can remember being in college and hearing a very similar proposal from then President Clinton, and of course ending college and graduate school and still being saddled with student loan debt. I heard him say, "Don't ask, don't tell," will be repealed. I heard him press for the passage of the flawed and yet still sweeping health care reform bill. So I heard these sort of moments. But I think far more important from my perspective was President Obama making a particular call to both Americans at large and elected officials to reimagine what participatory democracy is. So there were all of these sort of agenda items. Some are likely to come to pass. Most are unlikely. But the real issue is he suggested that we have to redefine what it means to be governing together in a diverse and complex society.
How did he say that? What part of the speech was that?
Yeah, so he said we have to stop behaving as though every single day is an election. He suggested that if the GOP was going to demand 60 votes for passage of any bill, then they would have to take responsibility for gridlock and failures in government. And most important, he said, we have to stop pretending as though beating your opponent is actually winning, that winning needs to be redefined as moving towards collective goals for all Americans, rather than simply, you know, whether or not a given party wins a seat. I think it was an important reinterpretation of the Massachusetts victory.
And you don't think that's partisanship in the guise of nonpartisanship, that that's the way Democrats fight when Republicans are opposing them? I think we heard the same language from Clinton once upon a time. But ultimately, people disagree on how you accomplish those goals.
Well, you know, I actually think one of the major criticisms from people on the left is that Democrats don't fight that way.
Exactly. that he's not, because people will hold their nose. Some people, you know, diehard Democrats will hold their nose at that moment and say, come on, stop asking for a bipartisanship that will never come about. Let's get out there and fight.
But I think it's really important to distinguish between bipartisanship on one hand and the realities of living together in a difficult democratic system on the other. And I do think he was trying to thread that needle and do this sort of civics lesson in the middle of a State of the Union. It's not a matter of simply having one or two Republicans and or Joe Lieberman or Mary Landrieu agree with you. It's more a question of whether or not we're willing to recognize that, for example, passage of some sort of health care reform is necessary for the goals of both the people on the left and on the right, that we simply cannot continue to go forward with declining employment without providing some sort of safety net for American health outcomes.
So, listeners, what did you think about the president's balance between fight mode and bridge builder in general in his speech last night? That's another thing you can post about at WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer Show. We'll take phone calls on that in a little while. And you've come back to health care twice already, Professor Harris Lacewell. And for me, too, during the speech, I was hosting an online chat with about 700 listeners who were hanging out. And one of the biggest threads throughout the chat was people curious to see how and when he would address health care reform. And as you know, it took him until a full half hour into the speech. And so for people who didn't hear them, here are the president's full remarks, about a minute, on what Republicans hope is his Waterloo.
As temperatures cool, I want everyone to take another look at the plan we've proposed. There's a reason why many doctors, nurses, and healthcare experts who know our system best consider this approach a vast improvement over the status quo. But if anyone from either party has a better approach that will bring down premiums, bring down the deficit, cover the uninsured, strengthen Medicare for seniors, and stop insurance company abuses, let me know. Let me know. Let me know. I'm eager to see it. Here's what I ask Congress, though. Don't walk away from reform. Not now. Not when we are so close. Let us find a way to come together and finish the job for the American people.
All right. President Obama from the State of the Union. Melissa Harris Lacewell from Princeton is here. How did you hear that section? Was it just necessary lip service? Was it amped up fight mode? How did you hear that?
Well, I mean, like much of the speech, it had this interesting sort of loose humor that was part of it. I mean, there were several moments where you saw the president reacting with a sense of almost diminishing the opposition through making them funny. How silly of you not to pass health care reform. How ridiculous to oppose climate change. Don't you understand how budgeting works? So I heard that as a similar kind of call to arms, but also a sense of saying, look, if you don't pass this, more than anything, you're simply ridiculous. I mean, do you have a better idea? If you have a better idea, feel free to tell me. I actually thought that was a pretty effective way of combating the opposition without appearing to be combative.
From our webpage, somebody posting as The Truth from Brooklyn. Don't you love people who post with names like The Truth? to ask if you feel better, because I asked, do you feel better about what Obama did for the economy last year after the speech than before? To ask if you feel better is to imply that you did not feel good before. So I will say again, I think the president did a great job last year. And I guess that's the truth, Professor Harris Lacewell. Did you hear it as I heard it, that he spent a lot of time defending last year? I heard one instant poll result today from CBS that found support for the health reform approach actually went up overnight from 54% to 66% because of the speech. Think that's possible? And did you hear it as a lot of either defense or defensiveness about 2009?
I heard him making a situational argument. So one of the problems in American politics, especially around the president, is that we tend to look at any sort of current moment and say all of this is the fault of, you know, the president at that moment, and particularly around the economy, which we have lots of reasons to think is not an accurate assessment of how economic fortunes occur. So what President Obama did last night was say, look, I know you guys like me. I did this whole sort of hope and change, almost messianic thing during the campaign, but here's what I inherited. Boom, boom, boom. The wars, the economic situation, you know, this huge deficit. I inherited that before I showed up. And what I'm trying to do, if you haven't noticed, is to pull us out of it, and it's going to take a minute. I actually thought that was a very, very effective way, again, of sort of combating the opposition that wants to lay all the blame at his doorstep without sort of saying, it's not my fault, and therefore there's nothing I can do. Instead, he pushed back and said, it's really the past 8 years, the decisions that were made by a Republican president and largely by a Republican House and Senate that led us to this situation, and now I'm trying to pull us out of it.
So,
I don't think that's completely fair. I mean, I don't know if it's the truth with a capital T, but it certainly is an effective piece of political rhetoric.
And in support of the truth with a capital T from Brooklyn, we note that that poll I cited already had 54% support for health care before last night, which is the same number I saw in the Kaiser poll taken earlier this month. So some people don't get that the majority still supports the basic approach. Last thing, we just have 30 seconds. Is his position as the first black president utterly irrelevant at this moment as you see it? He certainly didn't mention it. I haven't heard network pundits or critics mentioning
it. He must not have been watching MSNBC.
Well, I know Howard Feynman said it's irrelevant. That's what I saw, was Howard Feynman said it's irrelevant. So is it something more than that?
Well, I mean, I have to say that the funniest moment or most bizarre was Chris Matthews immediately after the speech saying, wow, I forgot he was black for a whole hour.
Yikes,
exactly. And so race is always there underneath. It's, you know, there's no way to be watching Barack Obama and not have a whole set of historic and personal emotions on him. And of course, he's always bringing African-American experience into the story, talking about Bloody Sunday as part of the American narrative of how we push back past difficult moments. But at the same time, this is not about a black president governing. This is about an embattled Democratic president governing with a huge Democratic majority that refuses to really pass this legislation. He told his party last night, stop running for the hills. Pass this legislation. And I have to say, for me, that was one of his strongest moments when he critiqued his own party and demanded their unity behind his presidency.
Melissa Harris-Lacewell, professor of politics and African-American studies at Princeton, thanks a lot.
Thanks.
Now, let me repeat. We cut taxes. We cut taxes. We cut taxes.
Okay, he only said it once, for real, in the State of the Union. We strung that together a few times for emphasis. But this was clearly a frustration of the president, not getting enough credit for cutting taxes. He went on. Nope. Okay, sorry, we don't have that clip. He went on to list many of the ways that he cut taxes in the State of the Union. And joining us next is Douglas Holtz-Aiken, former director of the Nonpartisan Congressional Budget Office, former chief economic policy advisor to the McCain for President campaign. Doug, thanks for doing this. Welcome back to WNYC.
It's great to be on the air. Thanks.
Is the president not getting enough credit for cutting taxes? In your own view, has he cut them meaningfully?
I don't think he's probably gotten as much credit as he'd like. We learned that last night. But I don't think he cut them meaningfully. I mean, if you look at the things for which he wants credit, They are the elements of the stimulus bill, make work pay, American Opportunity, enhanced child and EITC. Some of them are expansions of previous tax policy. All of them take the form of refundable credits, which are just disguised spending programs. And they are reminiscent of the Clinton administration, where this was the preferred tactic in an era of tight spending. And so
now let me play,
we're seeing it again.
Now let me play his list, and you tell me if you think that this list reflects what you just said.
We cut taxes for 95% of working families. We cut taxes for small businesses. We cut taxes for first-time home buyers. We cut taxes for parents trying to care for their children. We cut taxes for 8 million Americans paying for college. I thought I'd get some applause on that one. As a result, millions of Americans had more to spend on gas and food and other necessities, all of which helped businesses keep more workers. And we haven't raised income taxes by a single dime on a single person. Not a single dime.
All right, Douglas Holt taken. Come on back around and make your case again if you think that backs it up.
Well, I think it's exactly right. I mean, what did he talk about? He talked about make work pay. That's the working Americans. I left out the housing first-time home buyer, but I think anyone who looks at that from a dispassionate point of view recognizes that's bad policy to bribe people to buy houses at a time when our problem has been too many people are in homes. And it represents, I think, one of the real misuses of the tax code, which is to use it to engineer short-term economic performance and to engineer it for purposes other than its core goal, which is to raise the revenues necessary to finance the government. And if you look forward, this president has put out a budget last year which promises in 2019 to run a deficit of $1 trillion, long after the economy is assumed to have recovered, long after the financial crisis is in memory. And that deficit of $1 trillion has $800 billion, which is necessary just to pay interest on previous borrowing. So the promise to continually cut taxes while spending as much money as he intends to spend and continues to intend is a really misleading promise to the American people. It leads us to trouble.
Why not cut taxes on those lower down the chain rather than at the top, as he's doing and as you disapprove of? I mean, one could say rather than paying taxes.
I mean, it is important to recognize, it's just a matter of the facts, that half of Americans do not pay the income tax, and that the make work pay credit, the refundable child tax credit, the refundable earned income tax credit, all ensure that those who have zero tax liability also get a check from the government in addition to that. So it may be a matter of semantics, but the notion of cutting taxes for people with zero taxes is exactly what these policies do.
At the end of that clip, he also said, we haven't raised taxes on a single person, not a single dime. Do you dispute that statement?
He hasn't yet, but he in the same speech promised to do so. And it has been the intention of the administration to raise taxes in the individual income tax to multinational corporations and thus put us further out of step with our competitive needs internationally. And I think one of the real weaknesses of this speech is that for a speech that was intended to reset Barack Obama's presidency, he spent too much time looking back, too much time relitigating clear policy errors of the past, and not enough time looking forward and trying to do the kinds of things that would be beneficial in both building some bipartisanship and in getting our fiscal house in order.
Former chief economic policy advisor to the McCain for President campaign, Douglas Holt Aiken, also former director of the Congressional Budget Office. And here might be one of those raises of taxes that you were referring to. If you consider this a tax hike, here's the president, after taking credit for cutting taxes there, proposing to raise one fee, called it a fee, on bailed out banks.
And we've recovered most of the money we spent on the banks. Most, but not all. To recover the rest, I've proposed a fee on the biggest banks. Now, Now, I know Wall Street isn't keen on this idea, but if these firms can afford to hand out big bonuses again, they can afford a modest fee to pay back the taxpayers who rescued them in their time of need.
Populist grandstanding, Douglas Holtz-Aiken, or equity and good economics, in your opinion?
A little both. I think it's, you know, obviously he led with populist grandstanding on the banks at several points. The reality is that the law, the TARP law, required recovery of any taxpayer funds, and this would do it. I think most people who've looked at the details of this proposal would like to see it shaped to more comprehensively recover funds in a way that reflects where losses were. The big losses came in AIG, which wouldn't pay anything back. It came in the auto companies, which wouldn't pay anything back, or GMAC. So the notion of recovering the funds, it's the law. Doing it in a way that reflects the assistance that firms got, I think would make a lot of sense. And this doesn't do that yet.
How about the capital gains tax abolition, really, on investment in small business that he proposed? Are those and anything else that he put in the speech toward the direction of bipartisan tax policy, in your opinion?
I think they were. I mean, I think the world would be a very different place if he had begun last year talking about the desirability of reducing the burden on small businesses, having them carry the load in job creation, keeping our fiscal picture in order. It's a year later. These proposals are small bore by comparison to a $1 trillion stimulus bill. They will have beneficial but modest effects.
Tax credit for small businesses that create jobs. You like that idea or don't like it?
It's the best blackboard idea you've ever seen, and it's really hard to do well. And I look forward to watching the House and Senate try to figure out how to make this work. It was tried in the Carter administration, failed miserably. Always sounds great, but we shall see.
Is there a contradiction between businesses that say, I'm not going to create a whole job just for a $3,000 tax credit, and then the same business turns around and says, well, if you raise my taxes $3,000 to pay for health care, then I'm going to lay people off?
In the end, I can't look at the internal books of any firm, but we know that these incentives matter. We know that imposing costs on firms at a time when the labor market is weak gets in the way of hiring, and we know that subsidies may help them hire some. I don't think, in the end, those are going to be the central pieces of recovery. The central pieces of recovery will come from the vast amount of corrective effort made by the Federal Reserve in our financial system, the natural recovery mechanisms of economies, and we're beginning to see that. Housing starts only fall so far. Inventories only get stripped so far. And we're beginning to see the rebuilding that comes after those events. And with that, ultimately, will come some genuine job growth. It's going to take a while.
One, I know you're going to go in a minute. One more economy clip from the president, and give us a quick response. Did this part surprise you?
So tonight, we set a new goal. We will double our exports over the next 5 years, an increase that will support 2 million jobs in America. To help meet this goal, we're launching a national export initiative that will help farmers and small businesses increase their exports and reform export controls consistent with national security.
Surprised to hear him talk about exports?
Delighted, but as is the difference between campaigning and governing, we shall see. This is a president who had a very bad record on trade during the campaign and has done little to correct it in office. So, nice words. Let's see the action.
And he said he wants to balance free trade and environmental and labor standards. That's always the balance. It's always difficult to walk that line. Does it mean he favors a weak dollar to make exports attractive, and is that a good thing?
You don't know what he means, in fact. He talked in glowing terms about trade relations with Colombia, Panama, South Korea, trade agreements which have been passed or sitting there waiting to get finished by the United States and which his administration has not touched. So, the president is very good about talking toward the center, but he has governed to the left. This is a center-right country. That's why he's in trouble. And when he governs closer to how he talks, his problems will disappear.
Douglas Holtz-Aiken, former economic advisor to the McCain campaign, former director of the Congressional Budget Office. Thanks a lot for doing this with us.
Thank you.
And listeners, when we come back, we'll go to your calls. for your reactions to the State of the Union. And I have a couple of questions out there, but you can say anything you want. After watching or listening to the speech, do you feel better about what the president has done on the economy so far since he spent so much time making that case? And also, what did you think about his balance between fight mode and postpartisan reaching out? 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. Your calls in a minute. And then to Rufus Griscom from Bad Parent, his question for this week: what's so bad about spoiling your children? Stay with us.
Our administration has had some political setbacks this year, and some of them were deserved. But I wake up every day knowing that they are nothing compared to the setbacks that families all across this country have faced this year. And what keeps me going, what keeps me fighting, is that despite all these setbacks, that spirit of determination and optimism, that fundamental decency that has always been at the core of the American people, that lives on. It lives on in the struggling small business owner who wrote to me of his company. None of us, he said, are willing to consider even slightly that we might fail.
President Obama, and the Mountain Goats. And now to your calls. Greg in Huntington, you're on WNYC. Hi, Greg. Thanks for calling.
Hey, thank you. I love this show.
Thank you.
One of the things about watching last night's speech that broke my heart is that there's no longer a call for greatness in our country. You find heroes in our smallest areas, like policemen, firemen, the rescue people in Haiti. But our leaders, there's just no call to greatness. And I think Obama hit it right on the head. Everybody's running to be reelected because they don't want to be unemployed. And when you talk about our history, what made our founding fathers great is that they wanted to just be great. There's no greatness in our politics anymore. Everybody's striving to just be reelected, and that's striving for something greater than themselves. And it just broke my heart last night. Just broke my heart.
Did you feel better or worse about him watching last night, or not much different?
I felt better about him because here he struggles with one hand on his ideals, and the other hand, on the reality that people don't want to live up to, like, they want to live up to how do they keep their job. And I think if you're going to run for office and be an elected official, you have to reach for ideals. You have to reach and stretch yourself for greatness. And I was inspired by him, and I've always been inspired by him, because he's saying, I want to be great, and I'm not even going to see the benefits. I'll be long gone out of office when all this stuff gets implemented, but I still want to implement it.
Great.
And that's a sign of greatness. And it's just the bipartisanship that gets in the way of that. It breaks my heart.
Greg, thank you. Thank you for your call. Tom in Seabright, you're on WNYC. Hi, Tom.
Hi, good morning. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Well, you know, I listened to his speech, and he just seems, and plus with his hug of Tim Geithner, I think he's just rearranging the deck chairs on the Titanic. There has to be, especially he's talking about lowering taxes, that Reagan-esque mantra that we've heard for 30 years. Where did that get us? There has to be a structural change in this society from the top down, or nothing's going to get better. In the 50s, the top tax rate was in the 90s. It went down to the 60s before Reagan to below 30 with at the end of Reagan. Now it's in the high 20s. Has things gotten better? Has there been a trickle down? Have all boats floated? It's the conventional wisdom is wrong, and it has to be changed.
If when the banks crashed, we then went into a recession, almost a depression, does that make somewhat of a case for trickle down?
Well, I don't think so. If you assume that, they've all been saying this generalization that things would have been worse. Look what happened in Mexico in the mid-90s. They said the same thing there. Things got worse after their banks were bailed out. It depends. If it's working for you, this country, if you're making money, if you have a good life, if you can afford luxuries and leisure and a healthy, happy retirement and watch your kids grow and have some help, hope for their futures, then capitalism is good. But if you're in the vast majority that aren't part of that, capitalism isn't good.
Tom, I'm going to leave it there, get some other voices on. Thank you very much. Christy in Guilford, you're on WNYC. Hi, Christy.
Hi, how are you?
Good. How's Connecticut today?
Oh, it's snowy.
Yeah. New York, too.
My comment really is, like you asked, if do I feel good, better before or better after, whatever.
About his economic policies of the last year, yeah.
Yeah, well, I think Obama's on the right track. I felt there was a need to, like, really tighten up and to show some muscle and a little bit more leadership. And what I was really happy about was that he, held the Republicans accountable for roadblocking and called on the Democrats to, stand up and fight. I mean, I think this is, it's just crazy when you have that kind of gridlock in your, political house there. So,
what does it mean to you? How do they fight if they can't get Ben Nelson and Joe Lieberman, who caucuses with the Democrats, on board for some of these things? What does it mean?
Well, it means those people shouldn't, I don't know. I would never vote for Joe Lieberman again, number one. Number two.
Yeah, he's your senator.
I'm telling everybody I know not to vote for Joe.
But what does it mean to fight? If you're calling, and we have a lot of callers saying, the president has to show some fight. This bipartisan reach out is not going to mean anything. They have to fight. What does it mean? Do you stand up there and vilify the Republicans? And
no,
what does that change?
What my recommendation was, which I wrote to I think the president and to my Senator Dodd, let the Republicans filibuster. Let them be the ones that grind the government to halt. You mm-hmm. have to sometimes have the balls, mm-hmm. pardon my French, to, actually let people do what it is they think they're setting out to do.
Christy, thank you. And that was one of the key lines that I think we'll hear a lot from the president and other Democrats in the coming weeks and months, which is if you're going to be the party of no, when you have the power with 41 votes in the Senate, that's not enough. You have to come up with meaningful alternatives. The Republicans will say they have them. But Michael in Harlem, you're on WNYC. Hi, Michael.
Yes, good morning. I don't know why people aren't looking at history and why people are expecting so much after such a short amount of time. Franklin Roosevelt took 10 years and a world war to end the Great Depression. And in 1937, when he dropped the ball about pursuing the Depression and went back to try to tackle the deficit spending, to reduce deficit spending, that's when he worsened the Depression and went on and on until the war. And Obama simply hasn't been given any credit for averting our having our own Great Depression, and one simply does not understand it, that he has had such problems, and one doesn't know how do you attribute it to anything other than race. People who care so little about the well-being of this nation that they prefer gridlock. And once people realize the benefits that they derive from this health care benefit, that's why they've worked so hard, they know they'll never be able to elect any Republicans again once we pass health care and people see the hoax that was played on this nation with death panels and all of those lies.
Do you think that if Bill Clinton, say, had proposed the exact same policies, that the response from Republicans and public opinion would have been any different to your race point?
I think that the response would have been the same, but I think that he would have had an easier time trying to get at least some modicum of bipartisanship. And I don't think that you would have had people being able to be as effective in telling their lies. Just like during the Monica Lewinsky thing, the Congress counted, the Republicans in the Congress counted on people being against Clinton because of Monica Lewinsky, and one thing that, to the great credit of the American people, they always said, this is not anything that's important or that impacts my life.
Michael, I'm going to leave it there. Thank you very much. And Michael in Harlem gets the last word for this segment. We'll come back to the State of the Union in a little bit, but you can keep posting on our webpage, WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer Show and answer the questions. Do you feel better after hearing the speech about the president's 2009 economic policies than you did before? And did he strike the right balance between fighting the Republicans and reaching out? And anything else you want to write at WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer Show. More on the air about the State of the Union in a little bit. But first, we'll conclude our Bad Parent series in just a minute in defense of spoiling your child. Stay tuned.